There are not a lot of people who don't know the name Shapiro. Jonathan Shapiro, our most eminent cartoonist, is someone who has drawn every seminal moment into history. He's made caricatures of all the famous and important people, and if he's done one of you, you can consider yourself famous and important. We had a quick catch-up in Cape Town this year, where he discussed all the controversies of what's going on in the ANC and the president suing him and what we should and shouldn't be paying attention to, a little bit about social media and his method, where he comes up with his ideas, where he sits and draws his pictures, his cartoons, and how he has become a conduit for many South Africans' feelings, thoughts, ideas, the stuff that makes us move forward or backward as a nation. Here he is, Shapiro. CliffCentral.com. Shapiro is going to be with us in just a moment. He's got a brand new book out called Dead President Walking.
Okay.
So he was not deterred by the social justice warriors at all.
No, he's got a picture of the zombified President Jacob Zuma, and you can actually see the Union buildings through a giant hole in his body. And there are many cannonballs lying behind him, including 783 charges, Gandla, Gupta's spy tapes, rape trial, Concord ruling, Nene Gate, and yet he keeps walking. You know? Yeah, just another day for the president.
Now, he's provided a lot of entertainment, clearly. But what happens when we actually have a good president? What then does Shapiro do?
Oh, there is so much. There is still so much. You've still got sports, you've still got opposition parties, you've still got...
At that point, he was going to a well-deserved retirement.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is, yeah.
He is South Africa's preeminent cartoonist, and I don't like to rank people or to say anything about who fits in where, but anywhere in the world, this guy's got to be right up there. He has certainly made international headlines before. He's done some of the most incredible work that chronicles the history of this country and gives us a pause to reflect on either how far or how narrow our small victories might be. But I just love it. There is nobody I know that doesn't love the work of Shapiro. He's just recently started doing cartoons for the Daily Maverick. And we know the guys from the Daily Maverick well.
Yes.
Used to do the Mail and Guardian. They couldn't afford you anymore. You just, you know.
No doubt. Other circumstances.
I'm kidding. I'm just looking for trouble.
Yeah.
But this new book of yours looks absolutely incredible. I haven't had a chance yet to go through it from cover to cover. But I've been watching. You know, I pretty much can't wait every week for your latest cartoon. You are the best social commentator we've got.
Oh yeah, Gareth. Thanks. I mean, I'm one of social commentators that luckily I think South Africa really has had an unbelievably vibrant civil society, media. There are people who are out there commenting. There are people who are in different ways. I mean, and you know, look at a guy like Trevor Noah, who jumped from where we are to where he is now. You know, there's quality here, and there really are great people doing a lot of stuff, and all of it kind of feeds into something. So even if you can't see always, you know, cause and effect from one cartoon or one piece of satire that you do, it feeds into something which really is important in our social fabric. You know, that's what keeps us going.
Now you intrigued me when you sat down. You said you've had interesting experiences this week with Trevor Noah, Barack Obama, and the Arch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a guest list.
The week before last, it was just one of those weeks where, you know, it, being a cartoonist is a strange thing. You know, you sit in isolation in your studio. Most of us do. It's not like the old days where you kind of were part of a newspaper and you're in an office in a place like we are now, where you're speaking to people all the time. I do speak to people, of course, but I'm kind of in isolation, and suddenly I'm sort of pulled out into things all over the place. And I heard that the Arch was going to be in Hermanus, and I managed to – he's sort of been very much in kind of almost second retirement, the way Madiba was, you
right.
know. And I didn't want to have a special engagement – you know, where I kind of monopolize him because I know that he's tired and he's been through a lot and he's, you know, his health is. So I thought I'll try and piggyback, and I managed to get in on a book signing. You know, I've been lucky enough to have many fantastic encounters with the Arch and been with him and, you know, many times. But I wanted to present him with my latest figurine. I had one for myself and one for him. We're getting the rest of them that are being manufactured. We're getting them in sometime. And I managed to do this with the help of his minders.
I've just got to tell you, these figurines are amazing. There's a Madiba, there's a Julius Malema, there's a Jacob Zuma, and there's a Desmond Tutu. Are there any others? Are these the...
That's the four we're doing at the moment. And the Beautiful. Arch is the last one. And I only just got it in after he had his, you know, his most recent health scare operation and all that. So it was a big moment for me to actually see him again, and he was so warm and he absolutely loved it, and he, you know, his hands, he's got those special hands, and he was holding this thing, and my hands were underneath his, and I've got some really great pictures.
Oh, Jonathan, I love this. Is most beautiful figurine I have ever seen.
Yeah, you're doing. Yeah. You can replace Nick Rabinowitz on the yeah. And then Nick voices the puppet, which is also
in Zanews. Yeah.
Anyway, it was a fantastic encounter. So that was the one thing. And then,
but he's such a lovable guy. I mean, he really is a national treasure.
He is phenomenal.
And I keep telling people the only real celebrity in South Africa now, it used to be him and Madiba, but now the only one left is him. There isn't anyone in the world who doesn't know who he is, doesn't know the face, isn't able to put, you know, kind of a character to that face. And for South Africa, he's probably our very best ambassador when he's on form. And obviously, we have a problem in this country letting people go into quiet retirement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he even as he got older and older, I think now it's really difficult. Now it's going to be harder for him to kind of really get out there and
he's in his 80s.
He's well into, I mean, but apart from that, his health has really failed him in the last while. And he was fantastic at close quarters with a whole lot of people. He still wants to be that person that he sees how much people are inspired by just being around him. And he loves that. He loves interacting. But, you know, he's been until very recently, he's been speaking out on anything, whether it's, you know, whether it's Israel-Palestine or whether it is, you know, politics in other parts of the world, things that are happening here that he's condemning, comparing, you know, what is happening now with some of the things that happened during apartheid, not making a direct comparison.
But he gets into trouble.
Occasionally he has made a direct comparison. But, you know, that's the kind of person that he is. And by the way, if we were to do one more figurine, even though she's no longer in office, it would have been Tuli
Madonsela.
And she wrote full armor. That's what I wanted to do, the next one, in sort of public protector's armor.
She wrote a very nice testimonial on the back of your book. She said, I don't always agree with the Zapira. You can almost hear her say it in a very sort of dry tone. I don't always agree with Zapira's cartoons, but his wit, brilliance and relevance can't be ignored.
Yeah, I wrote to her. I wrote back when I got there, and I said, I didn't expect anything else from you. You know, it's not like she's not going to roll over backwards and say, I agree with every one of, you know. She's
totally
is
impartial.
Critical, impartial. Yeah. She's brilliant, and she's a huge inspiration. And she's part of what I was talking about earlier, that other part of society that is a corrective to the Jacob Zuma cabal and the rot and the corruption that has set in. She is one of those people appointed by Zuma who was supposed to be, I suppose, a lackey for him, and she absolutely was not. And Mokgweng Mokgweng, who I condemned roundly when he came in.
All of us did, yeah.
Yeah, and has also been that kind of person. He's also been part of the corrective. So, you know, we have people like that around.
But you haven't finished your story, because you said Desmond Tutu. What about Trevor Noah and Barack Obama?
Yeah, Trevor Noah, that was funny. The you know, when I was busy involved in a documentary. There's a documentary that's being done on the showerhead, and so that's going to be pretty interesting. There's all kinds of stuff, and the things are being raised. And so I was sort of out of the news loop for that day. And the director, near the end of the day, said, by the way, have you heard about the golden shower? And I said,
Donald Trump.
Yeah. I said, what? He said, that's the intelligence thing that the Russians have on Trump, and that the U.S. have given some credence to, the U.S. intelligence. And I said, no, that's incredible. And you know, my mind started working. Sat down at my computer, and I saw that there were messages from my editor at Maverick and from Rico, Madam and Eve, my competitor and friend, who said, well, this is for you, not for me. And anyway, so there were a bunch of them, people saying shower, shower, and I said, absolutely. I did the golden shower on Trump. Yeah. And it was also because Trevor Noah had really popularized this thing. He did this fantastic piece on The Daily Show with the golden shower, which I then went and watched. So I thanked Branko and Rico and Trevor Noah and Zuma and the cartoon gods. And now I've done three of these cartoons with Trump, and he's going to have this golden shower. And it's like the most perfect thing for me. So I sent a message. I tried to find Trevor. I used to have his email and everything. And eventually I found the email. I thought, is this Trevor's email? Yes, he answers back. How's it? And I said, hey, listen, brilliant, fantastic. Congrats on everything. I haven't spoken to you for a long time. Thanks for that shower stuff. It is like a golden opportunity, sure, so to speak, for me.
Excuse the pun.
So then he sends back something saying, I bet my staff you would do it. So you won me money and a gift. And I thought, okay, that's my next shot on my next book. I'll have to ask him. But I mean, that was so funny that he had actually spoken to his guys there and said, oh, well, there's this guy back home who does a shower on Zoom. I bet you he puts one on Trump.
He keeps up pretty good contact with this side, I think he's acutely aware of this being his environment for a lot of where the comedy comes from, and his understanding of not just obviously the United States but the world.
Yeah.
So I think he's proud of that. But I mean, you deserve every one of those compliments. I also see on the back of your book here, in 2016, you were awarded the annual EWK Prize, which is named after Evert Karlsson, right?
Yeah.
That's in Sweden, and New York's
top 10
online lifestyle magazine. One of the world's top 10 cartoonists. Well, I don't think anyone's going to argue with that. How many books have you put out at this point?
This is the 21st annual, but I have another three because I have the big one on Madiba, called the Mandela Files, the big hardcover.
Yes.
And then I have the Vuvuzela Nation, which has also got the arch and Madiba on the front, sort of blowing Vuvuzelas. It's the sport book and the 20 years of sport, and then the 20 years of democracy, the Democrazy, which is a big thick book as well. So there's actually 24 books out. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
What a career. I mean, when you look back, and to me, you're one of those people who really doesn't have to give your credentials, but you've been forced in the last year to actually have to stand up for yourself, because there's such an ill wind of political correctness that occasionally blows. For you, it's no news because you've been here before. You've felt the same kind of pressures under the old regime. You have pretty damn good struggle credentials, if you don't mind my saying, ahead of anyone else. But it seems even you were targeted online, because occasionally you step into places where people say, oh, no, but, you know, that's not funny. You're not allowed to laugh about that.
These days you can say, it's hard to say even anybody. I mean, you could say even the Arch, even Tuli Martinsella, even, you know, people much more important, people who have been – When they take on this sort of cabal that I was talking about, and in my case this wasn't exactly the cabal, it's people, it's another kind of branch of sort of political correctness that jumped in on my thing, and it's happened. I know it's happened to you. It's happened to many, many people. That was a cartoon that I did about Sean Abrams when you know, another Zuma appointee, but not like Mokgweng Mokgweng and not like Tuli Martinsella. He was appointed.
He's craven.
Yeah, he was appointed to be a lackey to prevent the corruption charges from being brought against Jacob Zuma. He was, you know, that's why he's at the NPA.
Right.
So I did him as a puppet of Zuma. And once I thought, God, I'm so tired of puppet cartoons and marionettes and, you know, in the pocket and all. I've done all of those. I've done every kind of version of wind-up toys and this and that. And I thought, and then I had this notion of, I was thinking of another organ of state captured. And it was actually, I think it was even before the word captured became a vogue word, but I was just thinking another organ of state gone. And so I thought, well, organ of state, another organ of state, that's the NPA, mm-hmm. and there's the Jacob Zuma as the organ grinder, mm-hmm. another organ grinder's monkey. No. And you've got this little.
It's a well-known
monkey.
Trope, right?
Yeah, it's a well-known
Speak
metaphor.
Speak to the organ grinder, not the monkey. That's what they say.
And it also the way that I drew, I knew very well about those old, as you use the word tropes, the sort of racist trope of the very black monkey and a sort of a generalized version of black people as monkeys. I would never ever. You know, wallow in that kind of stuff. Here was a large human person, Jacob Zuma, with a little guy in sort of monkeyish guy, Sean Abrams with a sort of bellhops hat on, and exactly like those old drawings of the organ grinder's monkey. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, there's one larger main target of the drawing who's very human, and then he's got his own monkey. By the way. Samora Machel used that very analogy about two black people as well, and that was brought to my attention by Ronnie Casserles and Mweletsi Mbeki.
It was also something that Robert Mugabe made a speech about once, not so long ago, about you know, the organ grinder and the monkey, referring to the Western world and their influence in Africa. So this is not something which is particular to any race group, and it certainly isn't the most offensive thing you've ever drawn.
No, and in fact, the cartoon for a couple of days, it was just being talked about politically, and people, you know, the people were divided. Some people were saying I was expecting the worst as usual, and other people were saying it's absolutely right. And then it was Eusebius Makaza and a couple of other people who picked it out. And you know, he's an opportunist. He's a careerist. He's also very brilliant. He sees a gap.
You think he's brilliant?
He's brilliant. He can be brilliant and he can be stupid as well. I mean, he's you know, he's both. Actually, I've been told by somebody I respect. Not to even go there. I shouldn't even mention him. He said, Eusebius Makaza, I'm not going to say who it was, but he said he's like a room full of jelly. You can get in, but you can't get out. So, you know, you can.
He also looks like he's full of jelly, if you ask me. Like a huge helping.
Yeah. No, anyway, so I shouldn't even have gone there because now I've given him another, like him and his Twitterati
but here's the deal, right? You've put out a cartoon at least every week for the last however many years.
You keep talking about weekly.
I used to do
six a week. I've done seven a week. I've done five a week.
At least
four a week now, which is little for me.
I know, but this is something that you've established an enormous reputation, and people love your work, and you've got massive credibility. And for this one cartoon to have caused as much noise as it did must have taken even you by surprise. You've done much more biting, cutting, satirical stuff before in your life.
You know, the Lady Justice cartoon is the most powerful and most impactful cartoon that I've ever done. And there were people who tried to paint it as racist, the main one being Baleka Mbete, and Zuma sort of piggybacked on her version of it.
Yeah, but you've been sued by the president. You're one of the few people.
Yeah, twice. And major lawsuits that went on, one for 6 years, one for 4 years. In fact, the one for 4 years was that very cartoon, the Lady Justice cartoon. And there have been many
Was
times,
that ever resolved?
Yeah, they after, well, it was a day before it was due to go to court in 2012, just before Mangong. Yeah, a day before, they eventually dropped all the charges. And Zuma himself was the one who wanted to keep it going. His lawyers were telling him not to. It's very interesting. I don't understand.
He's prickly like Trump, huh?
Yeah, but...
Very sensitive to criticism.
But you sometimes you don't know exactly what he's doing. Because in Brett Murray's case, I was very involved with Brett and what happened with the spear.
The spear,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah. And there it was the ANC suing Brett and the gallery and City Press. It wasn't Zuma. And there the ANC wanted to push it and Zuma was a bit reluctant for some reason. In my case, it was Zuma personally suing me, and his lawyers were telling him it's not going to go well, and just before Mangung, and he was the one who wanted to drive it. So there are wheels within wheels, and he's got about three teams of lawyers, and you know, and they all each team is as incompetent as the next. They kind of compete for like who's the most incompetent team of lawyers that he has around him. It's unbelievable, because every time he actually tries, that whole Stalingrad thing of, you know, we'll stop it, nothing, we'll push it, use every legal loophole, you know, they get stumped, because the people on the other side are brilliant. In my case, I've got the best people on freedom of expression, Dario Milo and Weber Wenzel, his team right. are absolutely fantastic. They briefed, in this case, it was Wim Trengrove was ready to kind of take these guys to pieces. And, you know, Zuma's lawyers.
It's a classy legal team that you got there.
Yeah, no, I've worked with Dario Milo and his team, because I've been sued more, not only by Zuma. I'm actually at the moment, there's a Vivian Reddy, one of Zuma's buddies, has a lawsuit out against me.
For?
Well, he started his letters of demand for another cartoon that was in the Mail and Guardian, where he said he's in the cartoon, but it was his son, and even his son is innocent. So there's that, and Vivian Reddy also has a crimen injuria case unresolved out against me for a cartoon I did where I used the Indian depicted them as the Hindu god Ganesha, you know, the elephant with many arms.
Yes, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, some of the religious groups get completely crazy, which is, it's going to be very fascinating to see what happens with the new hate speech, you know, this hate speech.
Well, we hope that this hate speech bill doesn't go through, because it'll kill a lot of of interesting social discourse, let alone humor. But Jonathan, does it surprise you? Because out of all the people in a society, often the man or woman who does the cartoons is the one who's holding up a mirror to what's going on. Most of the stuff, it's not as if you sit there and have to make it up. It's all just landing on your lap very often. It's then your job to interpret that and put it into a picture. It has to be, it's even more succinct than a tweet.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're going a step further, and I'm glad, than most people, because most people say the material just kind of writes itself, and it's there. The thing about interpreting is the difficult bit.
Yes.
Already about 16 years ago, I did a cartoon of myself on a therapist's couch, and the therapist is saying to me, since when have you been feeling these feelings of uselessness? And I said, since last week, when reality became weirder than anything I could dream up. And there's some newspaper headlines on the ground, which actually a couple of them are already so familiar to us that, you know, we kind of accept it. Cops install panic button to call a security firm, you know, that kind of stuff we know has happened so much. And there was something else, whole school stolen. Those are real South African headlines. But that's the point, is there is stuff happening here that is so out there that it's hard to keep up and to go beyond that and interpret it and still feel like you're edgy and you're doing something. If you can't just repeat what's in the headlines, because that's not satire.
Yeah.
Satire is when you're, as you said, holding a mirror up and showing it's something that's even more exaggerated or sharper or just twisted in a way that says, if we carry on going in this direction, this is where we're going to get to.
Yeah, but your cartoons are like little snapshots too of social commentary and of warnings some of the time and of celebrations some of the time, but they really do the job that words sometimes can't.
And look, I think that's the attempt. I mean, that is the genre of cartooning for me is it's one of the most interesting genres, because it combines images and words and an understanding of what's going on, and it uses two things. It uses the hyperbole, the exaggeration of something, and as I said, if something is pretty exaggerated already, you've got to go a step further. So exaggeration and the hypothetical, the what if, So what if it goes? So now let's take something like Zuma. You take someone like Trump, and the stuff is amazing. I mean, people are talking with Trump. They're talking about 1984. It's, the book 1984. George sales Orwell. Of it have spiked because Trump, the double speak, new speak, all that stuff. It's out there. So how do you take that further? I mean, a year ago, I did a cartoon of Trump, like Nightmare on Elm Street. It was Nightmare on Pennsylvania Avenue, and this kind of giant worm thing comes out through the White House. It's in there. It's in that book, and I'm kind of proud of that cartoon because it was the hyperbole, it was the hypothetical. But I did not believe it was going to happen. But that's the sort of stuff that we're doing. As I said, cause and effect, well, it's hard to see. I mean, the damn guy did become president, and despite the fact that people around the world were criticizing, were satirizing, whatever. But that's, yeah, that hypothetical and the hyperbole, those are the things that we deal with. And if you get that right, it can be quite a powerful mix.
Do you think that some of the times that you get into the worst trouble, like let's take last year's example, which is ridiculous, the Sean Abrams cartoon. Do you think sometimes it's because there are nefarious agents at work who are obviously they're on their own mission to get something out there and to kind of make it a story for their own device and purposes?
Black Ops.
Sure.
I mean, it's just happened now. You've seen that there are people who are doing fake tweets, fake all sorts of things.
Right.
There are people doing that kind of stuff. And the more desperate political parties get, the more they do that. It's Watergate Watergate was Nixon. And now there's been a lot of stuff that Trump's
people are doing.
And
it's always when people are in trouble that they start doing this. It's never when they're actually in the pound seats. I mean,
exactly.
Nixon didn't have to do this at the time that he went into the whole Watergate situation.
Well, remember, he was president and he was under pressure. I mean, first he managed to get in, but he was under a lot of pressure. And there was Vietnam and there was this.
This is my second point. Yeah. Is partly it's the black ops and it's a cynical kind of agenda being driven. But the other part of it is people don't read and people don't have a sense of humor. Not everybody.
Yeah.
Most of the people who enjoy your work week after week, they do it because they've got the cop. They know what the monkey organ grinder trope is. They've read enough books to know that that's an actual thing and it has the least to do with the monkey.
Look, I think that is you can't rely on that, on people knowing all that stuff so much. You can't always rely on that. What you can rely on is that the public kind of understands what you're trying to do. But we've had an interesting situation happen with social media. Social media has got its pros and its cons, and there have been so many discussions on this. But they all have different variations. In a way, there's been a democratization of voices,
and that's one thing. Everybody loves that, right? That's a good thing. We should be pleased and proud of that.
But many mastheads, many newspapers that have things online or just online productions have actually had to take away their comments page because there was so much abuse and so little positive. I'm not talking about positive in the sense of
nasty,
of sunshine,
racist, vicious,
stuff that wasn't contributing to the debate but was just like mudslinging.
There are a lot of shitheads in the world.
Yeah,
just plenty of shitheads.
So the problem with that, the whole social media thing, is that it's actually, on the one side that's giving people voices, on the other side, it's like a verbal sewer. Mm. So that's a real problem. And I think that people who are grandstanding or who are doing fake stuff or who are trying to bring someone down, take on the argument, it's like religious people. I've always said about religious fanatics or religious adherents who don't think is that they spend their lives waiting to be offended. Mm. That's what gives them reason for being. And in a way, if you have people who are, say, fallists who only want to take down a certain kind of group, or you have like people who said it was better in the old days during apartheid and and who want to reinforce their argument, they will have a bunch of people around there who will sit and cherry pick and will fake things and will just sort of a grandstand, and you could get a kind of a lynch mob mentality very quickly.
This manufactured outrage must drive you crazy, because it drives me crazy. In a world where there are really things we should be outraged by, there are things that we should be upset by.
Of course.
There are real humanitarian crises in the world, crises rather. Yeah. There are things like Syria that are going on. There are things like this ban of Trump's that's a real thing. But people are crying wolf about transgender bathrooms and about Donald Trump being an actual Hitler. And then it gets lost in this muddy, messy place where there are real issues, but they somehow are submerged beneath the fake outrage issues because they generate more noise.
I mean, and that goes back to the thing of racism, where there clearly are real racists and there are people who are continuing
And real racists, by the way, will let you know when they're real racists.
Yeah,
They're the first ones to offer up evidence of the fact that they're terrible people. You don't have to go and dig. You don't have to get into psychological examinations of these people. But they'll find you, someone who's got a proud track record of criticizing in the most blunt and sometimes in the most artistic and beautiful and eloquent terms the old regime, and someone who has you were actually an activist in real life, not just in cartoons, and they'll say, well, you know, he's because of a Sean Abrams cartoon, clearly he's just a bad person.
You know, my friend Marianne Tam, who's well known to most people, who
she's a terrific,
I'm sure.
Terrific,
she's
writer.
Amazing,
yeah.
Great
we've
writer.
Met her on the show before. Yeah,
yeah.
Very smart woman.
And Marianne, I always have to credit her for this, but I mean, she basically has talked about this being the era of the tabula rasa, the blank slate. So every single moment is a blank slate, whereas people, there used to be a chance to have a history, a track record, a conversation, a continuum. Now what happens is that moment that you do that one cartoon, or you have that one tweet, or you have where somebody can take that apart, decontextualize it, and put it on that blank slate and say, well, that's Gareth Cliff, or that is Tuli Maroncello, that is Tutu, that is Zapira, that is whatever.
And sometimes they've even decided that before.
That's right.
The material.
And they wait. Some of those people are actually waiting for something that they can decontextualize and then use against somebody, because they're finding it hard to actually take on the argument. That's the era of the blank slate.
That's a good point.
And I think it's an amazing way of thinking
about. You said something very interesting, so if you don't mind, I'm going to stop you. You said often it's when they don't have a very good argument that they go for the ad hominem attacks.
Yes, no, exactly. And I mean, I think that's the problem. That's the flip side of where social media has taken us. You know, it's really amazing that people can have the voice, but it's so easy to get this kind of lynch mob going, and over things that are totally ridiculous. By the way, speaking of, this is a nice little neat segue, speaking of people who read and don't read, I mean, Trump, I'm sure, I'm the first one to admit that I don't read enough books, but Trump is someone who clearly has his worldview is unbelievable. I don't know what he's ever read.
I think he's read his own books, and I think he's read Ayn Rand, and that's it.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. And apparently Obama.
Atlas Shrugged, I think, is the only book on his shelf.
Yeah. And Obama apparently has like an hour a day set aside. I mean, in his incredible schedule that he's had, he apparently reads, his reading list is phenomenal. I was just hearing about this recently. Apparently, he's such a well-read, such an amazing
You told us
person.
About Trevor Noah. You told us about the Arch, but you didn't get to Obama. So how did you had some interaction with him?
Yeah,
week before last.
Well, somebody came to my gate the other day, and a messenger person, but sort of fairly official looking, and he said, and as I arrived at the gate, my little dog was yapping, so I sort of spoke to the guy and said, "Are you coming in?" And he said, "No. Are you Jonathan Shapiro?" Which is unusual, because usually they just deliver it to an address.
Mm.
So I said yes. So he said, "Must I sign for that?" No. He just wanted to make sure it was me, and then he was gone. So I thought, that's interesting. Anyway, I kind of ripped open the envelope, And then I thought, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Because inside was a beautiful, small kind of buff color, like a sort of a kind of putty-colored envelope with a little thing at the top left that said, the White House. So I looked at the other one, and I managed to save. I'd actually kept the other, which is the big manila envelope that was inside. I actually hadn't. I'd only ripped the front, but not the back. It also said the White House, and it said Jonathan. It said Shapiro in brackets, Jonathan Shapiro, and then my address. And there was so this little envelope that I had. I opened it, and there's a beautiful little card with the White House crest embossed.
Yeah.
And handwritten. It says, Dear Jonathan, thank you for the wonderful cartoon. And I'll tell you about why that happened. Thank you. Nelson Mandela's funeral is indeed one of the memorable moments of my presidency, Barack Obama.
Good God.
Oh, and I must have got
chills.
Yeah, I did. I did. And I absolutely did. I had heard that somebody I know was going to the White House. And there was a chance that you have dinner with Obama in a group dinner, whatever. And it was actually my son suggested, why don't you send him a cartoon? So I picked one that had Obama and Zuma, and Obama was giving his great oration about Madiba at the funeral. And you know, there's Obama speaking, and in the speech balloon, there's this image of Madiba and all the great words of integrity and principle,
yeah,
and all the stuff
I remember that cartoon.
And on the right hand side there's another lectern where Jacob Zuma is standing kind of looking hunched over, and his shower is just showering him because it rained that day and he got booed. And that was that comparison. And so bombing about Zuma in the cartoon, but clearly, you know, he kind of got it.
Wow, what a week, yeah. You had last year.
Yeah, it was quite something. Yeah,
I there are a couple of things I need to know about, but I think let's just go to the beginning for people who don't know. How did you actually get into this? What was your life before you became Shapiro? And how did you become a cartoonist?
But, you know, in a way, I always was. It's in my head, I was a cartoonist already when I was a kid. I mean, that's what I thought I was going to be. And initially, though, I mean, I think when I was around, well, I do tell the story, and it's true, that I started really, really getting into drawing and loving cartoons and looking at Giles' books. My mother was from, it was actually British. Well, she was a refugee from the Nazis who became British. And we always had the Giles books, and she got, you know, even we had about 20 already, I think, when I was a kid. And I used to love the covers and things. And then I used to have nightmares, and my mom said, you know, she had good insight, and she said, well, why don't you draw what's troubling you, what you see? And I drew these monsters with as many claws and teeth and things, you know, scales and funny tails and spikes and whatever. And it actually helped me kind of figure out my nightmares and get over it. And I kind of carried on drawing. And I've done a comic strip where sort of as an adult, I'm carrying on drawing the monsters and adding more teeth. You know, when I was in detention, actually, I had drawing PW on the wall with more teeth and all that. You know, so but I felt I was already that guy when I was a kid. But the first thing I wanted to be was actually an assistant to Hergé or Charles Schulz. Hergé did Tintin. Charles Schulz did Peanuts.
Peanuts.
And Tintin, I discovered when I was 7, somebody started reading me one of the books. And I mean, like many kids, I just fell in love with it, but I never stopped. I mean, still a huge influence. And, you know, I went to the Tintin studios in Brussels and tried to meet Hergé and all that when I was 21, and I missed him by a day.
But you also love Uderzo, who does Asterix.
I did meet Uderzo. I rang his doorbell at 11 o'clock at night in Paris. I got lost, and he was still awake, and he was a hell of a nice to me. And that was really important, to meet a guy like that who was so nice to me. And I was trying to think, can I leave architecture, which I was studying to try and stay out of the army, and actually go and take the plunge and be a cartoonist? And a guy who's like one of the greatest cartoonists in the world invites me into his house, and he can't even speak English. I mean, I'm saying I'm from South Africa. I'm sorry, I'm a scruffy student with, you know, stubble like I've got now, and a backpack, and you know, I've rung his doorbell at 11 o'clock, and I said, I'm sorry, I got lost, and I wanted to ask you some things about, and he said, entree, and then I realized his wife comes down the stairs, also still dressed, thank goodness, and then he says, something about Afrique du Sud, and I realize he can't speak English, and like, what are we going to do? And then the door opens from outside, and his daughter, about my age, comes in, and she's studying English at the Sorbonne, and so she then sort of translates for the next few minutes, and he says, oh, he looks at my drawing, très bien, very good, and he gave me encouragement, and it was,
God,
so it was a big moment. Yeah, things like, so, but I was studying architecture, as I said, to try and get a profession and stay out of the army, because I think I lost confidence at some point, you know, during high school, I lost confidence that I could be. I mean, you think about the dark days in the 70s where we were completely isolated and apartheid was in its absolute pomp, you know, 60s and 70s. And it's, you know, you had, I'd seen Verwoerd and Forster was, it was Forster, still prime minister. Forster was still prime minister when I started architecture in 1977. I know that dates me. And then, you know, during that year, Biko was first detained and then killed by the security police, and all those organizations were banned, and the newspapers were shut down and things like that. And I saw that stuff, and I started to think, well, I don't know what I'm doing here. And in 1981, when I traveled in my fourth year of architecture, I was thinking to myself, you know, really, a lecturer, an architectural lecturer who died not too long ago, Gakko Paul Ruggini, he one day distracted me from my work, and he was going to be my examiner the next day. And he said, come on, let's go for a drive. And I said, you know, I've got to finish, you know, you're going to be examining. I was working for him, and also he was my examiner. And he's eventually, after like half an hour of trying to do this, I said, okay, let's go. And he said, see how easy you are to distract. So I cursed him. And then he said, we sort of sat looking over Cape Town, beautiful view. And he said, are you passionate about architecture? And I said, I like architecture. Are you passionate about cartooning? And I said, absolutely, I love it. He said, well, get the hell out of here. Go and do it.
Really?
Yeah.
One of those aha moments.
It was. It's not the only moment, but it's one. And then I went traveling, and then I went to meet these guys. I went to try and meet Hergé. I went to meet Udazo. I came back, and I said to my parents, I've got to actually become a cartoonist. I've got to give up the architecture. And my parents were amazing. But the army then that jumped on me and pulled me out of varsity as I started doing really well in graphic design.
You know, so Nobody under the age of 40 will ever know what that's like. I can't even imagine where a country just grabs you and puts you to use for something you don't necessarily believe in or understand,
yeah,
and risks your life on your own behalf without your permission. And the only way to get out of it is to basically make yourself a criminal.
Well, I mean, I know people who pretended to be crazy. Some of them got away with that. And some of them became a little bit crazy by trying to pretend to be crazy. It actually could, it was a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, yeah, people who actually went into the sort of psych wards and really had a hard time. I know people who actually were pulled into those kind of operational areas and went and fought against for apartheid and did terrible things, saw terrible things, and were scarred for life. I know people who went into the townships. I know people who refused and went to jail. You know, all of the above. In my case, I wasn't connected to any organizations when I went in. I became involved in political organizations, in UDF and ECC and all those things, while I was in the army. But when I went in, I was not connected, so I wasn't in a position to be a full conscientious objector. I mean, I kind of didn't. I knew it was a 6-year jail sentence.
Yeah.
So I went in And what I did was I refused to carry a gun. And I was singled out of the 700. There were four of us refusing guns, but three of them were religious, and they had letters from there. There was a Christadelphian, a Plymouth Brethren, and I still remember Christadelphian, Plymouth Brethren, and Jehovah's Witness, who were just regarded as slackmensa.
Yeah.
They were like the right. sort of weaklings whose churches said they're supposed to be, you know, non-combatants. Me, I was the Opstürker. I was the agitator out of the 700. They really made it their business to try and break me. And I managed to survive that first 6-7 weeks. I got really fit in 3 weeks, which you can do when you're 23. And I was very fit, so I managed to withstand anything they threw at me. And then they gave me a lead pole to carry, because they said, you know, you have to carry something. So I then have this lead pole, which the lieutenant one Sunday afternoon made. He took this lead pole and he attached it to this funny piece of wood that looked like a rifle. But
yeah.
And then I had this joke rifle, which was just a fraction heavier than a normal one. But it was so weird. I became like a walking cartoon. And that for me was the beginning of my persona as someone who was kind of against the system. And in a way, I was a cartoon in my own head. I was a cartoon. This thing would, on a hot day, I'd stand on the parade ground and they'd say, "Skouer, Javier." And so you lift the thing up to put it against your shoulder. And on a hot day, the nails and wire would expand, so the thing would fall apart. So everyone's standing there,
like, and your gun's falling.
I'm like going ding ding ding, putting this thing together. And everyone's, you know that scene in Life of Brian where yeah. those guys are going, they say biggest dickest, and then everyone's, they're all laughing. They can't stop laughing. So these army guys, these soldiers next to me, are all like going, you know, they. And eventually, the corporal, who was so stupid and so dumb, that he made me stand guard with the thing outside the most public area of Voortrekkerhoogte Pretoria on a Sunday evening, beautiful Sunday evening. The double takes were like something out of a sort of a Mel Brooks movie. And these generals and majors and all that.
And there's you with your fake gun.
Yeah, the camp is being guarded. And, you know, they look and then they look back again, and then like you see them through the window. What the fuck? The next morning, all hell broke loose, and I was called into the commandant's office, and he said, "Who's done you fuck me, daddy?" And I said, "It was Corporal, whatever the guy's name was." So he called the guy in and he screamed at him for about 10 minutes. He got three extra duties, and then he said to me, "Take that thing. I never want to see it again."
Throw it away.
So I put it in a black plastic bag. And then when we had leave, you know, we had a weekend pass or something there, like everybody's going out. And then I've got this like thing, which everybody knows. Yes, I've got it in my studio. Everybody knows what it is.
Oh, wow.
And they kind of look, their eyes roll and say, "I fucking Shapiro again."
Jonathan, I want to know where you sit when you're doing your cartoons. What is your studio? What is your view out of your window there?
I can see just the edge of Devil's Peak.
Okay.
It's green, you know, it's sort of our garden out. And then, you know, if I go to the window, I can see a beautiful view of Devil's Peak. But I'm under the house. But separate from it. The mayhem that's in my studio cannot be in the house. We had to find.
Is it in the basement?
Well, you see, we're in Cape Town. There's so many places that are on steep slopes. So
yeah.
we're in a running zift on a very steep slope. So even though I'm below the house, I'm not a basement. I mean, the house is.
You're outside climbing the garden.
Yeah.
Okay.
You climb stairs. So, but it's completely separate because that, as I said, that mayhem that is, there's a lot of mayhem. There's a lot of angst that goes in. I have deadlines. I mean, I run on fear. That's my fuel, fear and coffee. But so it can't be in the house because that sort of pollutes the family stuff. I've got to keep it separate. But it's part of the thing of being a cartoonist, I think.
Do the rest of them know to leave you well alone when you're in there?
Yeah, I mean, they'll come down and they can come down and use all. I've got like fantastic machinery and materials and whatever. And the kids both have they've done art and they're both good and they like this. So they do different things. And so they'll come and get things and whatever. But they basically, yeah, they know that the bad craziness can happen there in that studio. So
do you have particular? I'm sure you know I'm like this, and I'm not a world famous cartoonist. But do you have a certain kind of pen, and you have stocks and stocks of it?
I am a dinosaur. Yeah. I've got those calligraphy pens that, yes, you know, you had to use when you were doing maps.
Those
when you
Osmeroid
were
Osmeroid ones.
Oh, not the Osmeroid, because those are kind of solid. I hated those. Those sort of those hard what are those things? Those hard what was the name of those pens? Anyway, no, mine are the flexible ones that you did maps with. You have that's those flexible ones. As you go around a corner, it goes thick and thin.
It bends a little bit, yeah.
And you get,
so everything looks like calligraphy.
Yeah, so you get that kind of nice
thick and thin
line.
Lines,
it gives the line some life.
Beautiful.
And I've got, so I had to get those. I first bought them in New York when I went to study in New York in 1988. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, or a Fulbright, but I called it a half-bright because it was not for a degree. They said it was a non-degree. So there was a store in New York called Pearl Paint, which was the greatest art store in the world. I mean, New York is the center of the universe.
Yes, and I agree.
And Pearl Paint is the center of the art universe. There's six floors of like everything that you could possibly imagine. I was like a kid in a candy store. You cannot be. I'd go in there even if I didn't need anything. I'd come out like with buckets of stuff. It's just absolutely stunning. And Pearl Paint, of course, is no more. It's closed. And all the stuff that I try and all the stuff that I've used over years and years, I don't like the young cartoonists. They don't even have originals. I don't even understand that. They have like virtual things. They do stuff on tablets and computers and whatever.
Right.
I can't do that. Even not only the young guys. I mean, even like Rico and Dorf Fedler. Rico's sort of my generation. Dorf Fedler's a generation ahead.
Yeah.
Some of them have embraced some of that stuff. I can't. I want an
paper
original
and ink.
Bristol board, which I can't. Every now and then I get a message saying you better like buy up the stock of this because that's going. The German paper that I use is going out. Nobody uses it anymore. And then the next thing is the ink that I use, the American ink I use, people aren't using that anymore. So I've got to buy up stock. And then I get like, I have an electric eraser, which I bought at Pearl Paint, and it still goes. And this little motor still goes after like 30 years or 29 years or something. I don't know what I'm going to do if it stops. But I have to get those lead things, you know, those funny erasers that you used to get at school, which were like half white and the other half
was
like gray,
blue, and it was meant to erase ink, which
made a mess.
Yeah, just tore the page apart.
Yeah. Well, if you have a little engine and you have a little sort of a spool of that thing, just a little thin thing, and it goes around very fast.
Yeah.
You can just, like, when somebody spills ink on your page, you can come there and you can go, and you just take that ink right off if you've got good paper, yeah.
Huh.
So that's what I've got. But I get those things from like Malaysia and Indonesia and whatever, and so I get stuff from all over the place. And I'm like, I think I keep things like Tippex and that in business because I still use Tippex.
We are one of the few people in the universe who still do. Listen, I could sit and talk to you all morning, but I just realized now, I just looked at the time and it's 9:00.
Jeez.
So we got to get the hell out of here. Please keep doing your amazing work and don't be deterred by the occasional idiots who don't understand humor and don't understand satire. You're such a national treasure, in fact, for the things that you put into these beautiful cartoons of yours.
Thanks, Gareth. It's been really great being here with you. I also can't believe it's already 9.
We're just getting into it.
Yeah, I mean, this whole hate speech thing, people must mobilize and actually look at it. Hate crimes are one thing. To link hate speech and hate crimes, which is what they're trying to do, before they actually happen, is weird. It's the wrong way to go.
You would give up your freedom of expression.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be the end of a lot of things.
And, you know, what you're doing here is very, really, really important. It's great.
Well, listen, man, we love you. Thank you very much. Jonathan Shapiro, Zapiro, and his new book is called Dead President Walking. These things should be on everybody's lists for birthdays, for Christmas, for just for no good reason at all, except that it's fantastic stuff to look at. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Garrett.
Thank you. All right, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. And thank you to Ben and Mubs in the studio. And don't worry. There's plenty of good stuff coming up today. Ben's got his show. We've got that's the sports show. We've got the Leadership Platform with Adrian Groenewald. That's brought to you by Sibanye Gold today. And plenty more. So we'll see you tomorrow, bright and early at 6 o'clock.
I'll see you guys on Friday.
Yeah, you're going to be live in Durban with us.
Exactly.
Right. Thank you, Sia. Yay. All right, everybody. Cheers. And blah, 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 blah.
CliffCentral.com.